At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
If I can be a winning Ryder Cup captain away, so is an exceptionally big deal, and it adds a lot to my legacy.
For the best Ryder Cup build-up reaction and exclusive interviews, go to otbsports.com/golfweekly and become an official friend of the pod now.
Pat Nevin, hello. Come on in. How you doing?
Hello, Joe. How are you? How are you? Having a very, very busy week, traveling quite a lot this week. So look a little bleedy-eyed, you'll understand.
No. You're buzzing. JP was saying you're watching a lot of football at the moment.
Yeah, I was down for the Champions League games, the Chelsea one. They played earlier against Zenit, which was really interesting. It was not a lot of goals, 1-0, but interesting game. Then straight up the road to see the Liverpool game, which was one of the most bizarre first halves I've seen in years. I mean, years. I don't know if you watched any of it. But Milan were so rank. They were so rotten for about 40 minutes. And it should have been 5-0. I mean, I just thought, I was saddened for Italian football that the great AC Milan should be playing like this. They were only 1-0 down, but it was embarrassing. And then they scored 2 goals before half. I've never seen such a one-sided game turn like that. Not just one-sided because one team had lots of play. One-sided because one team was just rubbish. They'd done a wee bit better in the second half and it became a good game, but the right team won. And then back up to Scotland, then back down again for covering the Chelsea game at Spurs, which was a very interesting game in itself. And I think a lot of people have been quite moved by, certainly Chelsea's second half performance. But I mean, that was an interesting one to watch, but I don't know if that even beat the one I sat and watched on the telly before that, the United one. I mean, that was extraordinary. I mean, honestly, I can still hear the people in the ears shouting about VAR in that game. It was extraordinary.
Well, let's start with Spurs, Chelsea then, and we'll absolutely get to West Ham, Manchester United. Thomas Tuchel has been lauded quite a bit for obvious reasons, and yesterday is just another exhibit in the collection, really, because the way he changed that game at halftime was just so striking. This was not just like-for-like substitution. This was positional switch. And he is generally pretty attached to Havertz and Mount and Lukaku, I guess, increasingly now, but that two in front of a one. And so I know, and I heard Martin Tyler say as much as well, when I saw Kante first on the halfway line as the second half was starting, I was thinking, well, is it Kovacic or Jorginho? And then he goes and changes the shape. And I mean, right from the first minute of that second half, that change just wrestled the game away from Spurs, who had pushed up very high on Chelsea and maybe caught them on the hop a touch in the first half.
We should have listened to my commentary, because I said it'll be Mount. And absolutely convinced it'll be Mount. And I'll tell you for why. I think he wants the 3-5-2, and I think he's wanted it for a little while, but he hasn't had the personnel to do it correctly. And I know Kante comes on, and you've got Kante, Jorginho, you know, obviously there alongside Kovacic. They're not a set three in between the two wing-backs. One will go, or sometimes two will go, but they are three midfielders. That's what they are. Now, Mount, to some degree, was doing a wee bit in the first half. Havertz was playing a little bit closer, but when you put Kante in there, it gives a different dynamic to it. And then you can say to Havertz, right, you just go up, stand beside or off or whatever, Lukaku, you're a duo now. And you put that three in the midfield there, and honestly, he's just won the league, the Champions League, with what is basically the 3-4-2-1. That's what he's won it with, right? And I think he's given up now. I think he doesn't want it anymore. I think he wants 3-5-2. And looking at it in that second half, particularly, it was sort of that a wee bit in the first half. Second half, with that group of players, oh my, it looks better. It looks much, much better than the team that just won the Champions League last season. The personnel, yes, because you've got Lukaku, but also that group in the middle there. Who would want to play against Jorginho, who was arguably the best midfielder at the Euros, Kante, who's unreal. He's just one of the best midfielders in the world, if not the best at what he does. And Kovacic is playing out of his skin just now. That's horrendous to play against, with the energy they've got and the attitude and the quality they've got. So I think looking forward with Chelsea now, yeah, he'll adapt it sometimes, but I think it'll be 3-5-2 from this season on, from here on in, if he can possibly play it. The 3-4-2-1, I think he's dumping it.
Interesting, right. And who'll be Lukaku's partner in crime more often than not, do you think?
Havertz. It will be Havertz. Havertz probably was the quietest player of the Chelsea, you know, starters, apart from Mount, who didn't have a massive impact in the game in the first half. But Havertz had an okay-ish game. But his intelligent running is amazing for Lukaku, because quite often Lukaku will play against one or two, usually two, but sometimes three, right? But if you go and put Havertz up there, he just drags them apart. And it was quite clear in the game against Zenit, Lukaku wasn't getting any space at all. Then he changed it to the two up front. Havertz dragged them a little bit further, back post. And if you get a chance, if anybody's a Chelsea fan or any fan, just have a look at what happens. Havertz moves up front with him. The ball comes in from Azpilicueta. But he's now Lukaku, he's now got a yard. Didn't have a yard before, there, two people, sometimes three on him. But that changed. It was also helped by the fact that Zenit went to a back four, not a back five. But I think he's seen it now. I think he knows. Lukaku will get you goals. But he'll get you more goals if there's somebody else stretching it and stretching those defenders. You can see his eyes light up that he's actually going and stepped on something even better. And I honestly, absolutely convinced he's going to go that way.
Okay, very interesting. Kante is just such a freak of nature. Like, even the first moment of the second half, there was a Spurs player in possession halfway line, maybe 10, 15 yards away from him. He just has this weird way of making 15 metres look like 2 yards.
Again, it's talked about this guy before. And again, any fans of other clubs will say to me, oh, it's just because you like Chelsea. It's not. If you know football at all, you look at somebody like that and you don't understand it. I hate not understanding how somebody does things, because you can usually analyse it and consider it. And I spent my life, even before I played professionally, I loved doing that with players. Just go and watch Celtic when I was a kid and analyse every movement of every player. And you can usually get a version of it. And there was one player, Tam Burns, I could never quite figure out how he beat people, because he was wonderful and elegant and slow, and people used to fall around him. And he was one, I could never copy his. But I've never seen anything like Kante. I have no idea how he does it. I don't know how you make up. I've had that joke in the past with you, where I think he can see into the future slightly. And there's a bit in me that he just, lots of players, you think, well, Dalglish used to run the first 5 yards in his head. They used to say that about him for Liverpool. Well, he's a bit like that. He kind of knows what people will generally do, what their natural movement is, and he kind of calculates it. And then he's there waiting for them. But it's even more than that, isn't it? It's just ultra, ultra weird. And it's a beautiful player to watch in his own way. A number of people said to me the last season, well, they can get rid of Kante now because they've got other players coming through. And I'm thinking, who would think of that? Why would you do that? I mean, you could actually play him in any of the positions in midfield, and you can play him the one off a striker, and they do a great job there too.
So Chelsea are starting to look ominous, and you've described there they might have found the new and improved formation, and there wasn't much wrong with the previous version. Thiago Silva is answering any doubts there may have been over his age, turning 37 very shortly. I mean, they just look fairly awesome, don't they?
They do at the moment. And again, I've said in the show before, if you watch Chelsea, try and see if anyone ever beats Rudiger. And the latest one was Harry went up against him and just looked at him and went, nah, just turned away again. So Rudiger's phenomenal at the moment. And he even scores a goal there. So no, it's not to say that. I'm not saying they're going to win the league. Absolutely. I mean, there are very good teams. Liverpool looking fabulous just now again. Really enjoyed, you know, watching them during the week there. I've seen them twice this season already. City have got this kind of weird feast or famine thing going on, haven't they? Mm-hmm. They either score 5 or 6 goals or none. It's a weird thing they've got going, and it's what everyone comes back down to with them, you know, but the centre forward question. But looking at Chelsea, everyone's saying, but what if Lukaku gets injured? Well, they won the Champions League without him last season, so you know, I'm just not sure there is a player. I mean, he's the one now, even though he's just in the door, that you probably think you couldn't do with him. You don't want him missing because he kind of gives a focus to it. But they won the Champions League without him last season. So if he keeps fit for the vast majority and keeps in the shape he's in, because the shape he's in, he doesn't actually look like the same physique. It's really, really hard to see a weakness. All the backup positions, there's no weakness there, Ryan.
I was curious to see my Timo Werner with a touch of the pressure and the responsibility off him come good. No early signs there. I'm starting to wonder what's gone awry with Werner.
In a day that we spoke about one of the greatest and most obviously natural strikers in the world that's ever seen, in Jimmy Greaves, Timo's not a natural striker, a scorer of goals, is he? It's just not what he is. I mean, he's a hard-working player. He gets into amazing positions. He's got good intelligence to get into those positions. He's actually also not a greedy player when he gets in front if he sees a better ball on. In fact, he's laid up Rudiger's goal at the weekend there. But natural striker, no. He had a one-on-one in a game. And you think about Chelsea, the weird player scored when Rudiger scored. Kante scores. I mean, I'm just thinking, all you need now is Kovacic and Timo Werner to score. And that's all the weird displays they've scored. But he didn't score when he had a one-on-one. And the classic example, as you say, had that been Lukaku, would he have clipped it over Lloris? Answer, yes. And that's the problem. He is certainly given different options. Is he going to be the guy that's going to get you 20 in the Premier League, 20-plus in the Premier League? I don't think he is. And I still don't think he is. But will he do a job in stretch players? Like I mentioned about Havertz, stretching, but that's just distance stretching, as in widening the game. Werner doesn't, he lengthens it. And Lukaku would love that as well, because if you lengthen the game, it frightens defenders, they run off you, and you've probably seen yourself that the ball played into Lukaku's feet, he loves it. Well, if the game's been stretched behind him, he's got all the time in the world to get that. Can I say one word of warning about Chelsea? And there is a word of warning, and it might not be obvious for another month or two yet. They're becoming slightly over dominant in one ball, and it's the ball directly into the feet of Lukaku to turn. It's a very, very common problem. You've got a big striker who's strong, who wants a ball, and he's a big character. That's not the best thing to do with him. The best thing to do is use the wide players and use the intricacies you've got, and then sometimes play it into. They're getting a wee bit over dependent in that. It's a small thing. Something they shouldn't get over dependent on, and I think Tuchel's actually noticed that, hence he put another player up alongside him.
Okay, very interesting. What about Harry Kane then? No touches in the opposition box against Crystal Palace for the first time in his Spurs career in a 90-minute performance, and then I mean he looked far from uninterested. He's not a disconsolate figure sulking. If anything, he's coming deep and trying to get too involved, a bit too deep. I mean, at the stadium, are you looking at Kane thinking, what is the thinking here? I mean, I know you like coming deep and playmaking and you're quite good at it, but at times I would think that Thiago and Christensen and Rudiger were glancing at each other saying, well, this is okay.
Yeah. I mean, Son tried to run them a few times a little bit further forward than in the first half. Sometimes I think you come across and you think there's no space there. There's no angle there. There's no position there. There's nobody feeding anything into me. So you do, as you correctly say, you just naturally drop deeper. Sometimes a player doesn't even kind of know he's doing it. He's kind of just dropping because he wants to get involved in the game. And I think that might well be part of it. And we've watched Harry. We can't ignore the fact that we've watched Harry doing that and be brilliant in that position. You know, getting the ball and then playing through balls to particularly Son. In the first half, I don't know if you'd complain too much about it because, you know, there wasn't much of that in the game, and much in the game for either team. But in the second half, it just becomes more obvious. I still suspect the problem was more his teammates than him, to be fair. I think his teammates weren't getting enough of the ball in good positions. Him and Son's understanding hadn't worked on the day. But I felt a little bit sorry for the old Dele Alli seemed to come back again for this game. And Dele Alli's had a real resurgence, you know, this season, I think. But the old Dele Alli was back, who's kind of, you know, doesn't get as involved, seems as if everything's a problem. Complaining about everything to referees. He needs a right good Dele Alli beside him, you know, the best Dele Alli, and then you've got that three-pronged kind of feeling about them, and it can work. But they were missing a few players as well, and that can help. I won't write off Spurs just now, because I watched them right at the start of the season without Kane, And it was a friendly match, and they were down at Stamford Bridge, actually, and they were super. They were really good. So with a full compliment, I still think Spurs are not a bad side at all. The biggest disappointment is what everybody's seen on the day. They kind of chucked it after two. They just thought, nah, we've no chance here. And the shoulders had gone down, and it was a real capitulation. And it was a real sadness to see that stadium. Honestly, it looked at about 30% full with 5-10 minutes to go. It was a real shame.
Yeah, and there were boos at the end. Do you think it's a bad sign of a team to chuck it? Like, on a certain professional level, you're 2-0 down, everyone knows the game is up. Is it the end of the world if a team sort of drops by 10-15% and says, okay, right, lads, we'll forget about this? I presume it sort of happens. Like, we're talking about professionals, there's always another game, or is that a real no-no in your book?
I can't remember ever playing in a game like when that happened. I mean, maybe it is a thing that has happened and does happen, and maybe in modern football people think, look, there's another game in 3 days, we need to work that. But no, generally you fight. And whether it's fighting to get a point or whether it's fighting to make sure it doesn't go to 3 and 4 and you know, you just get the pride, whether it's you're 6 down and you don't want it to be 7, you fight. Whether any of them, you look up in those stands and you think, no, those people are paid and I've got professional pride. You just don't stop. I don't think there ever is a reason. And even if you're down to 10 men, you know, against a team that's better than you and everything's against you and the referee's been not somebody you would particularly like to spend the evening chatting to, it doesn't matter. You still battle and fight to the end because it can get horribly embarrassing. And I think most people felt that Spurs, the way it had gone there, and I'm not every player, not every player on the team, not saying that, but I think if you let 3 or 4 go like that, a 3 can turn into a 7-0. It can quite easily. And they were quite fortunate. Chelsea could easily have had 5 and 6 quite easily in that second half, and that's not what Spurs should be like. And it was, yes, Chelsea were good, but also Spurs, you don't just quit. You need to keep on fighting to the end. So no, I don't think that was good enough. And it's a surprise to see them doing that under Nuno.
Mark Noble's jogging to the penalty spot with the ball under his arm. What are your thoughts at that moment?
Oh, God. I feel sorry for him. I really, honestly, I felt terribly sorry for him because, you know, they have special teams in American football, don't they? When people come in and do that sort of thing and you're trained for it. But in football, it's so unusual to come on and do that sort of thing. And there must be a million things in his mind. Now, if the gaffer had, you know, prepped him for it, by the way, if anything happened in 5 minutes to go, you're on for a penalty. But it seemed a wee bit of a spur of the moment thing. And I know they're thinking, and Moise just thinks he doesn't miss, and he generally doesn't. He's the best penalty kick taker they've got. So you see them, the thinking there. And of course, he's a genius if it works. We all know that as well. But when you're coming on and you miss that, it's actually not a surprise, is it?
No.
You know, it isn't a surprise if you come on and miss that. Because there's a million things in your mind. You have to hit. And again, it's something I do often say, and I try not to say the same things all the time. If you hit a penalty kick in the Premier League and the keeper goes the right way, you better hit the side net. You better hit the side net because he'll save it. It wasn't hitting the side net, was it? So that's it. It's as simple as that. And the way he takes penalties, you know, we've seen a couple of the weekend even again, one particular one where, you know, it was the Brentford one where they took the one step, etc. But that's not the Noble penalty, is it? So he takes it. It's a good height. Yeah. It's actually not near the corner. In fact, it's not even a great save. It's just a decent save, you know. So everything was wrong about it. And I just felt really sorry for him because Moise was thinking everything's gone against him because some of the mad stuff that was going on. I mean, the penalty kick that they didn't get for the Wan-Bissaka thing, that's got me, man. I just don't get that. And don't blame VAR for that. The VAR got a chance to show it. It's the referees and the VAR assistants. That's not the tech. That's the human error that's making the mistakes there. Oh, God, that was driving me mad. There was a few stinkers at the weekend, wasn't it? But, you know, they played well.
Yeah.
They were the better team for periods. And I suppose even though United got the one, let's be honest about it, they can't be that excited about that. Because, you know, I'm not sure that was... It's a great win to win there because West Ham are a good side. But, you know, there was big bits missing there.
No, there's a lot wrong there with Manchester United for sure. When Mark Noble's running on, it's interesting that Moyes is almost smiling and looking up to heaven, and it's an expression that almost says, well, this is weird. as if, you know, he hasn't initiated the whole thing. And I mean, the point you make about the US special teams is you see the kicker warming up in the net for the moments before, and he knows there's, you know, potential at any moment and he's ready to go. Whereas Noble, I think, you know, was doing no warm up whatsoever. So, like, it was interesting that Moyes made the point afterwards in the interview that Noble is one of the best penalty takers in the Premier League, one of the best penalty takers in Europe. And when he said that, that suggested a man who knew the stats. You know, you don't just throw out the best in Europe in that kind of a way without knowing, well, Mark Noble is actually probably third in Europe, it will turn out. There now needs to be, for all these statisticians, there needs to be a new subsection with this statistic. There is the how good at penalties are you? And then there's the new subsection, which will start from, say, the Euro 2020 final. How good are you when it's your first kick of the game? And let's see if your stats hold up there. So far, Noble is 0 for 1, and the Euro 2020 boys didn't feature so well as well. I'm amazed so quickly after hot on the heels of Euro 2020 that he did it. To be fair, his logic was, I'd have been kicking myself if I didn't try it. Moyes' logic. But, I mean, I don't know.
He also knows what he's got on the pitch. Now, everyone will say, you know, professional footballers ought to be able to take penalty kicks. But who's he absolutely going to trust on the pitch that he's got on the pitch? You know, and maybe he's got a few that he thinks are half decent, but he knows he's got somebody who's brilliant at them. And also, let's be honest about it. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. He knows the stats. So somewhere it is in the back of his mind. But be fair. At no point during the week before the game is he thinking, right, if we get a penalty in the last minute, what I'm going to do is... It's not crossed his mind.
No.
He's made a spur of the moment one. Now, it's a spur of the moment, as many managers do. They put a lot of information into that spur of the moment. A football game, it's amazing how quickly your mind works. You can go, it's so rapid. And then you make that sort of decision. And then you can justify it to yourself. And imagine that, he was justifying it to himself all the way he was doing it. He also looked to heaven and thought, yeah, but. So he knew the yeah, buts. Yeah. He absolutely knew the yeah, buts. And I can't really have a go at a manager that does that. Because when we've seen it in the past, it's usually the keeper thing. We've seen that in the past, haven't we?
Which is so different.
It is very different. But they're not warmed up either.
No, but if it's a penalty shootout, they can kind of work their way into it. And even I think if you're coming off, no, I get that. But even if you're coming off the bench, there is a degree of, like, the onus is on the kicker and you're reacting. And actually, there's a degree, for some reason, when it's the penalty taker coming on, everybody thinks, well, you're at a bit of a disadvantage here. And that almost gives the keeper an edge. I think when the keeper is coming on, and we've seen Tuchel do this recently and we've seen Van Gaal do it, I think when the keeper's coming on, I think everyone's more inclined to think, oh, he must be really good at saving penalties. I don't know why that psychology is there, but that's how I feel it is.
You're absolutely right about that. And it's not something that's often said. The psychology is, oh, he must be good at penalties. But it's also having the psychology effect and the players that are going to take penalties against him thinking, well, what's he done that for? You know, I thought they had a decent keeper in. You know, is he extra special? Does he know something? Has he got better stats than the rest of it? He knows where I go. You've already started his brain twitching a little bit more than he normally would. So you're right. It is quite different. But I think it's one of those things. You take a chance now and again. And it's back to that old Jose Mourinho one. You know, classically, he would make a decision, and if it went badly wrong and you told him, he would turn around and go, yes, but I've done it 9 times before and it worked those 9 times. It is still the right decision, even though it went wrong this time. And I think Moise might say, I'll keep on letting him take penalties because, yeah, he'll keep on scoring them generally. And once he'll let us down, and that may be the once. You know, and he'll just shrug his shoulders. And that's what happens with managers. They take all those stats into mind. But you're right. The one stat you didn't take into mind was how many times did they do warm-ups during that second half to keep himself ready? Well, which I suspect was probably very few.
Yes, I'm looking forward to the next manager who has the guts to spring somebody from the bench. So I'll be watching with interest. On Liverpool, you mentioned Liverpool being very good and in a good place at the moment. And it does certainly seem as if the energy levels and the atmosphere is back to where I suspect Liverpool fans hoped it would be at the start of the season. So they beat Palace 3-0, this on the back of the Milan game, which you mentioned, and then they were very impressive against Leeds as well. And then a mixture of accident and design. Klopp's using lots of different players at the moment. Konate was in alongside Van Dijk, who obviously didn't play against Milan. Alexander-Arnold was ill, so Milner went in, and then Robertson was on the bench as well. Firmino was injured, so Jota's doing just fine. So the I suppose maybe other cause for optimism here is it's not just Liverpool's first 11-12 here doing this at the moment.
I would put a caveat on that. The Milan game, I say they did play well. They win the game 3-2. They were far better than Milan. There were problems. There were definite problems, and they were all generally defensively. There was a lot of mix-ups in that defence against a team that shouldn't have caused them any problems at all. Have a quick look at the Palace game. They were posted missing far more regularly than they should have been done. And again, usually in the same place behind that kind of centre-back, full-back area. And a particular chance when Odson Edouard got himself in an amazing position. He didn't have to do anything. It's good at the moment. It's lovely. And it's going forward. Midfield to front it seems absolutely fine. I'm not sure about the backups. If you had to keep on going with them week after week, I'm not sure against the big ones. I would hold off with that. I wouldn't dive in there and say that's a great squad now. That would be unfair. And it would be unfair in some of them as well.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they are of that level. I think the left back is. I think he's all right. He's going to be Robertson. Now they used to fear like anything. Robertson getting injured, they don't have to now. He's good enough. That's good. He did give away that. He should have. That was a penalty, wasn't it? I don't know if you've seen that one. That should have been a penalty when he clipped in the back post. But apart from that, he's been super.
I wonder is Klopp's logic here. And look, it can be undercut by the fact that if you get an injury, you can't pick and choose games. But I wonder is he thinking, well, I'm just about good enough to get away against the vast majority, and then obviously against the big boys I'm going to play my first 11, and that's where they could really have a go. You would still say there's a question mark over the squad for sure. If they can avoid injuries, they would look maybe like they'll get away with it against the Palaces of the world.
Oh yeah, absolutely, no doubt. I mean, if they can have another season like the seasons where they have one or two injuries and they don't get a Van Dijk injury and they don't get a Salah injury, they'll be fine. They'll be up there. They'll be up there, definitely top four, and you know, possibly even challenging as well. So I don't worry. I wouldn't worry if I was a Liverpool fan. But any Liverpool fan I ever talked to, they agree. They want more depth. They look at the other teams around and think, how come they can bring in six or seven players and they're all world class players? You know, Liverpool can't do that, and it does concern them, it does worry them, and rightly so. But there's another part to it, and it's a bit we kind of gloss over in the modern game, is see a tight group. Tight group's brilliant because everyone is working together. No one is walking about in a big huff all the time. It's kind of hard to keep these players happy all the time. You know, Wijnaldum left, you know, maybe he was getting a bit fed up with not quite getting enough games. There might be other reasons for players leaving. It's kind of hard to keep very, very high quality players that are, you know, what expected to play every week if they're internationals and they're not playing every week. Yeah. Try to keep them happy.
Yeah.
There is only one way to do it, and that's to win trophies. So Liverpool, you better win trophies if you're going to get that sort of squad.
I think Klopp tends to prefer a smaller squad as well for that very reason, tight bunch. So we mentioned Man City, and Guardiola's had an interesting week, obviously. Here's the context for Man City, and they are 3 points behind Manchester United, Liverpool and Chelsea. Their next three games, once they're done with the League Cup in the next couple of days, Chelsea Saturday, PSG Tuesday and then Liverpool Sunday. So Chelsea and Liverpool with PSG sandwiched in between. So where they are in relation to top of the table could be very interesting in just over a week's time. Pep Guardiola made the same point that you made on this, you know, feast or famine. He says, like, you know, I score and we score six Champions League, and then it's you know, the greatest team ever, and then we don't score, and it's, well, why didn't you buy a centre forward? They haven't, to be fair, scored in three of seven matches. I mean, that's not insignificant when we're talking here about Manchester City. Raheem Sterling played 90. He's started two of five games, didn't score. On the crowd thing and all that, and Pep, they were all there, it was a capacity crowd against Southampton on the back of the Leipzig Commons, and they were all singing Pep's name. I mean, I would think they are loath to get into a scrap with Pep.
Oh, the media would love it as well. So would all the other clubs love it. All Pep is saying, and, you know, I've got quite a lot of games at the Etihad. All Pep's saying is, if you go to Liverpool, if you go to Manchester United, this hurts. And if you go to even sometimes Chelsea as well, you're going to get some loud, mad, noisy fans on you, and helping you every step of the way. Doesn't always happen at the Etihad. Mm. It's harsh but true. It's just the way it is. It's harsh but true.
And was Main Road always pretty lively?
Yeah. Yeah, really. Yeah, absolutely. It was a brilliant place.
That'd be my sense of it. So is it just that it's hard to create an atmosphere in this bowl?
Maybe it is. Lots of other people will come away with lots of other reasons. It's a big old place to fill up. People who say, "Oh, they've been spoiled." Oh, I'm not having that. Man City fans haven't been spoiled for long enough to have that sort of effect on them. I don't think so, anyway. So it's kind of a weird one. It's a really weird. I hope it's not been too many parts have been made too corporate. I hope it's not that. But it's a weird thing to see. Now, I got a wee bit of stick because I actually mentioned this when I was doing. I was at the Liverpool game. Someone was talking about the lack of atmosphere. Over there, and it was a 6-3, and I said, "Wow, 6-3, and the atmosphere is not fantastic." I wasn't there, I couldn't tell you, but it was being relayed to me, and I said, "Well, that's amazing, because most teams in a 6-3 at home in a Champions League game, you'll only talk about that for the next 10 years, you know, because it's amazing, you know." But there is that, and all Pep's saying, he's not saying, you know, "I want you to spend 50 quid on a ticket," because it should be cheaper, and it would be helpful if it was much cheaper. And I think it would be better for them if they could drop the prices if they want to make sure every game was full. Then drop the prices if you can, if it's legal to do that, because sometimes it's not, because other people have the rights to it. But all he's saying is a simple thing. Other teams have got a bit of advantage. Our competitors at the moment get that every week. They get that noise every single week, and they can feed off it. And having been to a lot of games now when the places were empty, Man United weren't the same team without that crowd behind them. Liverpool weren't the same team without that crowd behind them. It means something. It absolutely means something. So it doesn't mean singing Pep's name for one or a couple of games. It means he wants it all the time. And I can't blame him for asking for it. I can't. I can blame him for maybe the way it was put, you know, because it is damned expensive. In simple terms, people can't afford it. So it may well be that, you know, if they can come to an agreement of, right, okay, certain games, if we can possibly make sure that these games are full by in certain areas cheaper, and we can get enough people in that are desperate to get in and watch this team, then that's where we will find the agreement. But it's important. He needs that noise. He absolutely does, because it's useful.
It must be heartbreaking for him as well, like, at times when they're good, and I'll come to the famine section in a moment, because that is interesting when it comes to City, but at times they're playing the most sublime football, and he must be thinking to himself, like, look what, you know, Barcelona they came, Munich they came, look what I'm giving you here. Why are there like 20,000 empty seats on a Champions League night when we're scoring 6 goals? What do I have to do? You know, I'm conducting the orchestra, I'm doing my part. So I sort of get that. I can see how you can become a little bit detached from ticket prices and those other kind of more day-to-day matters for the rest of us. What about the famine section then? The feast we get, and when they're good, they're very good. So, like I said, in 3 of 7 matches, they haven't scored, which is kind of interesting.
I think eventually, as this season goes on, we will find out if the answer is what everyone thought it was at the start. You know, Liverpool have got goal scorers, and quite obviously Salah is somebody who generally always gets over the 20 goals. He's not an out-and-out striker, but they've got someone who scores a good amount of goals, along with Mane. You look at Chelsea, what did they do? They went and bought a goal scorer. It's obvious. What did Manchester United do? They get Cristiano Ronaldo on top of a bunch of goal scorers they've got. And Aguero's not been replaced. He's just not been replaced. For that type of, you know, I'm not saying you need a wee guy like him or a big guy, just a nine, an absolute nine. And Pep's done it before. He did okay with Barcelona without an out-and-out nine for a period of time. He knows how to do it. He's capable of doing it. But if it doesn't work this season, and there are those famines that you don't get goals, you don't get that sneaky 1-0 when you needed the 1-0 because the poacher will actually go and put in that win opportunity, or in City's case, one of the 7 that he gets in a game, you know, it will be, the question will be correct to be asked. It's probably slightly early yet, because you can throw the stats back that, you know, they've lost one goal in the league this season and scored, is that 11, 12, something like that?
Yeah.
It's all right. It's quite good, you know, yeah. It's okay. But the problem is, is not levelled. It's just up and down too much. You would like two or three each game, and it's just not the way it's worked. But we, an out and out striker, there would be more certainty you would get that. But I'm again, far too early to jump on that bandwagon and say that's the problem and that's what's going to scupper them. I'll tell you one thing though, it's the problem that's most likely to scupper them. Yeah. I would definitely say that.
Well, Chelsea, PSG, Liverpool, going to be really interesting. One last quick one on Raheem Sterling. So he started 2 of 5 games. The other one he started was when it was himself and Grealish up against Spurs, and they were kind of taking turns against Tanganga. The Sterling that we saw for England during the Euros, I mean, looked really alive again and dangerous, and he's kind of almost returned maybe to the Sterling we saw last season increasingly at Manchester City. What's your read on what's going on there? Because when this guy's good, obviously he's phenomenal.
He is, and there should be plenty of space for him to use it, because if you get Grealish and get others that are moving really well for him, I suppose it's just creatives. I like that. They do go through spells sometimes where it doesn't work or happen for them for a variety of reasons. Somewhere in the background, I wonder about Raheem, that if there's negative things happening in the background of his life, he's quite affected by them. And he's, you know, I don't say that as a bad thing. I say that as somebody who has had to put up with a lot in his life. And I note the recent story that's... somebody's having a bit of a go of him about talking to a young player for an agent, and he claims that didn't happen. Now, if there's legal things happening behind the scenes, even if you believe there's nothing to fear and you've done nothing wrong, that's not easy. None of us can put that to the back of our mind all the time. I mean, if any of us listening, if you've ever been in a legal battle, be it big, small, and different, it plays on your mind.
Yeah,
and
it's there. All consuming.
Yeah, so there's something that's been going on in the background that's just beginning to leak out with this agent's thing. I suspect he'll be, you know, released from it quite quickly, but it doesn't mean seeing it's not affecting you. So it might be one or two little things like that. But again, he's another player. Again, I suspect he'll come through. But I do think that although he can play up front and he has looked good in that position, and sometimes even as a false nine he's been good, I do think he's a player who's better alongside an obvious striker.
Okay. Chelsea, Man City next week. We'll talk on Monday. Thanks, Pat Nevin.
Look forward to it. See you then. Bye-bye.
I mean, what sort of career, Jim? Let's think about it. Forget the money. Forget the money. Although it's very difficult to forget the money. But forget the money. What sort of a career offers you round the world free trips, keeping you perfectly fit, plenty of free time? What a career. Seriously, what a career we have.
Still he goes on, England. Greaves hanging back, gonna hit it! Oh, what a goal by Jimmy Greaves!
Greaves changing direction so well. Oh, beautiful football! What a great goal! Fabulous goal!
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. I could live through it again, absolutely 100%, with just a bit more money.
Football on Off the Ball.